Hello and welcome to Vanguard Audiobooks and the Learning College. I'm Alex Linder and you can find this and everything we record at vnnforum.com and also later permanently archived at alexlinder.com. Today we're going to resume with the Leo Frank case, The Lynching of a Guilty Man, volume number 3 of Nation of Islam's series, The Secret Relationship Between Blacks and Jews. And that covers Jewish domination of the slave trade, and then the Jewish domination of the slave products trade in the Americas. So Jews buy and ship these blacks from West Africa to the Americas, north and south, dominate the trade, dominate the agricultural products that the black slaves are used to produce. And then volume 3 is sort of the turning point in black-Jewish relations in the Americas, the Leo Frank case. And we're up to page 305, and we're going to go up to about 332, so about an hour, or 330, so about an hour today for this session. The section that we're doing, these again are not divided into chapters, just sections, they're not numbered. Answers to unanswered questions. So we've heard about the murder, the trial, the post-trial campaign by Northern Jews trying to get their man off or get his sentence commuted or at least lie to the country that he's the victim rather than the perpetrator. Now we move on to answers to unanswered questions. Jews have embraced the Leo Frank case as an almost sacred American metaphor for the mythic, age-old struggle of the Jewish people, and scholars supporting that view have manipulated the facts of the case to reinforce that interpretation. Frank, they say, was wholly innocent of the murder of Mary Fagan and unfairly persecuted by a hostile people and system like that of Pharaoh's Egypt. His death stands as proof of the need for American Jewish unity, for mutual empowerment and protection. Just beneath the surface of that narrative of Jewish suffering is a very visible undercurrent, a not-so-subtle indictment against a specific black man for both the murder of Mary Fagan and the, quote, anti-Semitic upheaval that engulfed the Jewish people of Atlanta, America, and the world. That racialized interpretation expands this Jewish tale into a commentary on the storied relationship between blacks and Jews. For many Jews, the Fagan murder was the crime of a black man, and so blacks must be added to the ranks of the historical oppressors of the Jewish people. That construction is a highly controversial point of view, which must be interrogated from a perspective never before applied to the case. And now that the framework of the murder, the trial, and the lynching of Leo Frank has been presented, we must take on individual aspects of the case to discern whether the previously drawn conclusions are still valid. Leo Frank had a hearing in front of more than a dozen official judicial bodies, all of which concluded that he was legitimately found guilty. But James Conley, the black man Frank's Jewish supporters have accused of the crime, has never had any hearing of any type. Some claim he died in 1962, others say he died in the 1970s, though no proof exists of either claim. Even so, Conley has been etched in the American Jewish consciousness as a villain next to the devil himself. Our re-examination of the Frank case will determine whether James Conley's ignominious fate as an enemy to the Jews is deserved. In targeting the various pillars of the Leo Frank legend, we start where the case appeared to end, with the lynching of Leo Frank at Fry's Gin in Marietta, Georgia. Subsection: The Strange Retreat of Leo Frank's Army. The lynching of Leo Frank outraged the Jewish people, who had followed the case as a cause celebre, but not enough, apparently, for them to use any of their previously deployed resources to track down Frank's murderers. This determined and uniform reluctance, almost as if their intent was to protect the perpetrators, has served only to focus more attention on those responsible for Frank's demise. Let us look at what did not happen after Frank's lynching, and then move on to a surprising examination of those assassins who have been charged with Frank's murder, the so-called Knights of Mary Fagan, capital K on the Knights. Knights of Mary Fagan. Leo Frank's executioners were characterized by their peers as, quote, sober, intelligent, of established good name and character, good American citizens, so the opposite of a mob of riffraff. Their identity seemed to have been well known in Georgia and included, quote, a clergyman, two former Superior Court justices, and ex-sheriff. Yet no serious attempt was made to arrest, prosecute, or punish them on either a local, state, or federal level. There was the initial bluster of editorials and government-offered rewards, much of the outrage coming from Georgia officials that included Governor Nathaniel E. Harris, who condemned the lynching and offered a hefty bounty for the arrest of those responsible. But Frank's international team of supporters and advocates, who had so vociferously screamed for the blood of, quote, the Negro, James Conley, made no attempt to go after Frank's actual killers. Oddly, the Frank family announced it, quote, would take no active part in any attempt to apprehend and convict the members of the lynching party, unquote. And when the state of Georgia officially concluded that the lynchers were, quote, unknown parties, unquote, the hyper-litigious Frank team simply let it go at that. Names of the participants were emerging within minutes of the lynching, yet no prominent Jews in or outside Georgia pursued any legal action against those individuals. Fear had never caused the Jews to refrain from applying the most aggressive tactics against Frank's accusers, yet they pursued no federal or international action, engaged no detective agencies, pressed no lawsuits through any court. Remarkably, there were no retaliatory actions taken that one would expect from a people who had liberally used and abused their range of powers as never before in the cause of Leo Frank. On the day that top Gentile officials in Georgia were establishing rewards for the capture of the lynchers, Rich's Department Store, the largest Jewish-owned retailer, advertised not a reward, but slipper buckles for 39 cents, lion's tooth powder for 19 cents, and petticoats for $1.19. In its post-lynching issue, the American Israelite, the most prominent national Jewish newspaper, counseled, quote, all talk of offering a reward for the conviction of the Georgia lynchers and all action in that direction, except by the constituted authorities of the state of Georgia, should cease at once. So I'm thinking they're thinking, well, he's dead. He's not coming back. Now he's of use to us. Mainly, he's good for Jews as a symbol. We'll make him the basis of America's original sin against Jews, their anti-Semitism. That's what I would think they were thinking. Jews, the paper wrote, were, quote, already suffering on account of the sentimental nonsense of a lot of fool friends who are not Jews and a lot of Jews who are fools. It strongly advised Jews, quote, to retire to the rear and call off their friends, unquote. Rewards and the talk of rewards quickly evaporated, and despite many promising leads to the identity of the lynchers, not a penny of those rewards was ever dispersed. Small efforts were made by rank-and-file citizens to establish reward funds, but all petered out for a lack of leadership and interest. Dr. Cyrus Adler, the chairman of the American Jewish Committee, AJC, declared that he and his organization would not join a group of Christians and Jews that formed to aid Georgia in the pursuit of the lynchers. Adler said that investigating the lynching was, for Georgia authorities, quote, alone. The Albert Lasker financed detectives and agents spared no expense in buying and inventing, quote, evidence to free their man, without regard to the rising anger of the citizenry over those tactics. Estimates of Lasker's contribution to the post-trial Leo Frank operation range as high as $120,000, today's equivalent $16 million. But nary a penny went toward tracking the kidnapper killers of Leo M. Frank. Is there any doubt that $1,000 dropped in the middle of Marietta, where the average annual earnings in 1915 were $687, and the price of a new home was $3,200, would lead to some crack in the estimated 40-man lynching team? So they're saying they could have effectively used money to find who was guilty, but they didn't. Frank's main attorney and the most prominent Jew in America, Lewis Marshall, who had been given the names of some of the actual murderers, instead publicly declared that Georgia newspaperman, quote, Tom Watson is the murderer of Leo Frank. Direct statement, end quote. And in a statement printed in the New York Times on August 18th, just one day after the lynching, Attorney Marshall was careful not to demand a full investigation and would only refer generally to the actual killers as a, quote, mob of assassins. He was joined in the same Times article by Frank supporters who, strangely, placed more emphasis on Watson's culpability than on that of the lynchers or the state officials responsible for their apprehension. The American Israelite had regularly reprinted the New York Times' commentary and added its own where required. But only a few days after the lynching, and without a single arrest having been made, the paper titled its article, quote, "A Few Final Words in the Frank Case," and therein terminated further discussion of the issue. Case closed. So once the act happens, they're completely unwilling to do anything, which is very interesting. Next section, Leo Frank's Mystery Assassins, colon, Knights of Mary Fagan, in quotes. Epigraph. It's fascinating the way it was planned. It was like the Israeli raid on Entebbe. It was a very well-oiled machine. Steve Oney was the one who wrote that. As scholars began to reconsider the case 50 years after the fact, they collectively affixed the name, quote, Knights of Mary Fagan, to the lynchers, and charged them with being the sole perpetrators of the crime. The group has been described as, quote, a secret order whose avowed purpose was to avenge Mary Fagan's death, unquote. But their reputation for organized terrorism has grown far beyond the lynching of Leo Frank. The Knights of Mary Fagan have been credited by these same writers and scholars as being the founding members of America's notorious racial terrorists, the Ku Klux Klan. The original Klan formed immediately after the Civil War, 1867, but dissolved after successfully impregnating American society and government with its racial ideology. Its rebirth in the 1910s, a response to increasing black political and economic activism, saw the new incarnation of the Klan grow to a reputed membership of over 5 million. Obviously, the birth of the most violent racial terrorists in American history is no less significant to blacks than the founding of German Nazism is to Jews. But anyone attempting to track the history of the so-called Knights of Mary Fagan will find that the group has almost no verifiable record of existence at all. No newspaper articles chronicle its activities. No organizational records plot its development. No law enforcement or intelligence agencies log its movements. No private correspondence or local memoirs make reference to this mysterious group said to be the progenitors of American racial terrorism. The strange career of the Knights of Mary Fagan begins not in Georgia, but 900 miles away in New York City. The first and only mention of this alleged team of assassins is found in a brief reference in the very newspaper now conceded to have been an avowed member of the Leo Frank defense team. The New York Times, under Adolph Ochs, OCHS, handled the post-trial propaganda for the Frank team, and in its June 26, 1915 issue, 7 weeks before the August 17th lynching, an anonymously written, quote, special article titled Violence Feared in Atlanta Today, purports to describe the reaction of Georgians to their governor's June 21st commutation of Frank's death sentence. It reports that, quote, authorities are apprehensive because of the number of secret mass meetings held in several towns. The last paragraph of the article identifies Frank's future assassins. Quote, block quote, one of the strangest of these meetings is reported to have been held at Marietta, where Mary Fagan is buried. 150 citizens are said to have met at Mary Fagan's grave and formed an oath-bound organization to avenge her death. This body is to be known as the Knights of Mary Fagan, and it is the purpose of the organizers to form lodges over Georgia, the members being pledged never to rest until the murder of the girl has been avenged. There seems to be little doubt that such a body has been formed. The text here reports on a mass meeting that was known to have been attended by the masses in Marietta, Georgia, but that somehow escaped the notice of the three Atlanta-based dailies, newspapers, just 20 miles away, which had been mercilessly competing to break any news of the Leo Frank case. No source is given for the New York Times' scoop, and not even the weekly Marietta Journal mentioned any of the alleged activity. The American Israelite ran a curious contribution to the Times' lone knight's claim. It is notable not only for its premonition of events to come, but also for its familial links to the New York Times. Adolf Ox was married to Effie Wise, W-I-S-E, whose father, Isaac Meyer Wise, founded the Israelite, and whose brother then ran it. Leo Wise added to the intrigue in his July 22nd issue. Block quote. 2 weeks ago, the Israelite stated with confidence that, quote, the attempt to revive the Ku Klux Klan in Georgia did not meet with any noticeable success, unquote. But the confidence was not well placed, for, by all accounts, some such outlaw organization having for its purpose the lynching of Frank has been established. This information comes from Atlanta by way of a special dispatch to the New York Times and is trustworthy where an Associated Press dispatch could not be accepted because the representatives of the latter have been under the same intimidating influences which were in evidence from the moment Frank was charged with the murder of Mary Fagan. That was from the July 22nd American Israelite. The Israelite did not name this group, but instead linked, quote, some such outlaw organization to the Ku Klux Klan. Speaking to its international Jewish readership, the Israelite editor insisted that the only legitimate source for future news of the Leo Frank case would be the paper of his brother-in-law, Ox's New York Times. Despite the worldwide coverage and the multitude of published verbiage on the case at that time, the sparse and fleeting mention in a newspaper that served as Frank's public relations arm is the only reference to the alleged, quote, secret meetings, unquote, or to the existence of the Knights of Mary Fagan. So there's one reference, and it's in the New York Times and nowhere else. And though the group is forecasted, quote, to form lodges over Georgia, there is no further evidence of such activity in any form. Such was the public's outrage over Slayton's action in Georgia that the local papers would have gladly aided with publicity any attempts to set up lodges for the purpose of avenging the death of Mary Fagan. The Knights would have sought such publicity, not shunned it, and just about every white man would have proudly joined. The idea that there was some power in Georgia from which the group needed to hide is without merit. The only photographs of Frank's lynching show white Georgians standing proudly next to the body, some straining to be included in the picture. Nevertheless, even after the actual lynching of Leo Frank on August 17th, the moniker Knights of Mary Fagan is not mentioned or reported in any of the worldwide newspaper coverage. Similarly, the literature and scholarship addressing the prodigious rise of the Ku Klux Klan in that era are devoid of any mention of the group, even though it is claimed by many to be the Klan's parent organization. So they're saying, the Knights of Mary Fagan, does it exist? If it exists, and it fathers the second version of the Klan that arose in the 1910s after having been originally in 1867 and then died down. Maybe a decade later, this is the second iteration of it, and it's fathered by this Mary Fagan case and the Knights of the Mary. Why isn't there any mention of it anywhere except one spare reference in the New York Times is what's going on here. It's very interesting. The reappearance of the so-called Knights of Mary Fagan in print would not occur for nearly half a century when a new layer of intrigue was added to the Frank case. In 1965, the popular Jewish writer Harry Golden pulled the New York Times' Knights from obscurity when he authored a book on the Frank case, A Little Girl is Dead. So the Jews, all right, let's pull back. They wait 50 years and then one of their so-called academics comes out with a new book called A Little Girl is Dead by Harry Golden, wherein, for the first time, the Knights are directly credited with Frank's murder. Golden was a beloved white liberal, well-known in civil rights circles, who at the time was the publisher of the Southern Jewish newspaper, Carolina Israelite. He was as clear as an editor could be about his claim. Block quote. The name Knights of Mary Fagan first appeared in the Jeffersonian, that is Thomas Watson's, either weekly or monthly, in the issue of June 24th, 1915, the issue that condemned Slayton's commutation. So, you know, about 6 weeks before, or six, seven, 8 weeks before Frank was lynched, this is the issue that condemns Slayton's commutation. Slayton was the governor. Tom Watson, in each issue thereafter, professed to see the great, quote, invisible power, unquote, of these knights. Again, this is a Jew mentioning it in a book written 50 years later, Harry Golden, A Little Girl Is Dead. Golden offers researchers a specific issue of Watson's local Georgia newspaper. So Jefferson was the newspaper, not his weekly or monthly. He did a weekly newspaper and a monthly magazine that he mostly wrote himself. And he was the main Aryan down there standing up to the Jews and their lies and their defamation of Georgia, as we heard in earlier sessions. So 50 years later, Night to Mary Fagan, which has one spare reference in the New York Times, is resuscitated by Harry Golden in A Little Girl Is Dead. And NOI says, Golden offers researchers a specific issue of Watson's local Georgia newspaper to confirm his account of the birth of the Knights of Mary Fagan. One should recall that Watson's vitriolic advocacy for Leo Frank's execution made him for many the voice of Georgia justice. He repudiated Governor Slayton for commuting Frank's death sentence, and he later cheered the lynching and the lynchers, who he believed had carried out a legal ruling of the Georgia courts. And it is for that cheerleading role that Watson was blamed by Frank's own legal team for the crime. So Golden's mention of Tom Watson and his Jeffersonian newspaper as the source of the term Knights of Mary Fagan appears plausible. It is strange, then, that the June 24, 1915 issue of the Jeffersonian has no such reference to the Knights at all. Nor is the group mentioned in any subsequent or previous issue of the weekly paper, the last issue being printed in 1917. His other publication, a monthly titled Watson's Magazine, dealt with the Leo Frank case extensively, and it is likewise devoid of any mention of the Knights. Harry Golden's private notes made during the preparation of his book, A Little Girl Is Dead, shed light on his thought process. On the specific issue of the Knights, his draft version of the book refers to the September 9, 1915 issue of the Jeffersonian. Yet again, a careful review of that issue contradicts Golden and shows that Watson proudly refers to the lynchers as the, quote, Cobb County Vigilantes, and then later as the Vigilantes, not as the, quote, Knights of Mary Fagan. Clearly, Watson would have been the first to join such an organization and to report on its noble activities, yet he knew nothing of the Phantom Group. Tom Watson and his publications are not the source of the Knights of Mary Fagan, and it is a mystery why Golden consciously conferred upon Watson fatherhood of the enigmatic group. Well, it's not a mystery. Jews are simply liars, and they're brazen liars because they're lying about something that can be checked, where they can be found to be lying, even while they're masquerading as academics. Any kind of degree or honor conferred upon them does nothing to change the inherent fact that they seem to be genetic and cultural liars, because they do it. Even when it can be proved they're lying, they don't care. They just make up lies because they intended to defame Tom Watson and, as they eventually did, rip down his statue in Atlanta and put one up of Leo Frank. In 1968, Leonard Dinnerstein followed on the heels of Golden in his own book on the subject, The Leo Frank Case, and he likewise claimed that Frank's lynchers were these, quote, Knights of Mary Fagan, and further credited them with originating the Ku Klux Klan. But his source for that fantastic assertion is none other than Harry Golden and his flawed book, A Little Girl Is Dead. So one Jew concocts a lie, and another Jew cites that original Jewish lie to add layer upon layer of lying until it's impacted lying across multiple generations is what Jews do. And thereby they create a false tapestry, a false history, a false narrative that they can use for propaganda to advance their racist goal against all others. Clearly uncomfortable with Golden's claim about the Knights, Dinnerstein wrote in a footnote, quote, I questioned Golden about the source for this information. He replied that he had heard it said and then had it confirmed in an interview with one of the lynchers and a son of this lyncher. So, just making stuff up is what Jews do. Steve Oney also promotes the Knights in his 2003 book, And the Dead Shall Rise, and cites only the same dubious New York Times article. He also takes unsupportable liberties when he adds, but provides no citation for, his claim that several of the so-called Knights of Mary Fagan were present before the prison commission to argue against the commutation of Leo Frank's death sentence. So Jews are just making stuff up. Golden died in 1981, but the 2007 edition of the Encyclopedia Judaica carries his embellishment of the Knights fable. Quote, Watson helped found the Knights of Mary Fagan, an anti-Semitic society which sought to organize a boycott of Jewish stores and businesses throughout Georgia. Oney joins Golden and Dinnerstein, so you've got 1965, 1968, and then Oney in 2003. They're all writing the same. They're adding to, or they're relying upon, they're building upon the foundational lies they created. Oney joins Golden and Dinnerstein, who have stitched the Knight's tale together from a wispy assortment of unidentified, unnamed, undocumented innuendos, rumors, and flights of imagination. After consulting the authors of the three standard books on the Leo Frank case, we find that the mystery of the origin of the Knights of Mary Fagan only deepens. So, the three standard books are all written by Jews about an affair in which a Jew is the guilty party. How about that? And again, as I always say, this case is a microcosm of how Jews operate, not only in the U.S., not only in the 20th century, but across all times and places. Everything they say has to be doubted, has to be assumed to be a lie until proven otherwise, and very seldom will be proven otherwise. Wherever there's an advantage to Jews to gain as a tribe by lying, they will lie. That's what history proves about the Jews. They are a race of liars. We're on 314, and the next section is Leo Frank legend infects black history. The, quote, evidence of any so-called Knights of Mary Fagan can at best be described as tissue thin, leaving no other paper trail than that which leads right back to the Leo Frank defense team. The mysterious group yet found its way into the voluminous literature on the notorious domestic terrorist organization, the Ku Klux Klan. The KKK earned its reputation for violent racial terrorism during the Reconstruction period following the Civil War. The Klan's role was simple: to do all in its power to force the freed slaves back into the critical roles they had held in slavery on the plantations, which were the engines of America's cotton economy. Without the vital labor of the African, forcibly extracted, the entire American economy would have collapsed. America embraced the new race enforcers as true patriots, preservers of a way of life that refused to die. By 1877, the Ku Kluxers had achieved their goal of locking white supremacy in the very foundation of every American institution, and the hoods, robes, and ropes were retired. So in 10 years, they accomplished their mission, and then they're gone, and then they don't reappear until 1910. So from 1880 to 1910, 1877 to 1910, that's 33 years. So for a generation, they're gone before they come back. So keep that in mind. A growing white nostalgia for the darkest days of slavery and an escalation in militancy among blacks created the climate for the Klan's reemergence in the 1910s. William J. Simmons, S-I-M-M-O-N-S, revived the secret order in a 1915 ceremony atop Stone Mountain in Georgia and led it to its largest growth in its history, with an increase in membership to an estimated 5 million. Simmons himself reverentially describes the beginnings of his new Ku Klux Klan in his book, The Klan Unmasked, yet he makes no mention of Leo Frank, Mary Fagan, or her knights. Even so, a cunning new version of the KKK's rebirth began appearing in scholarly literature that brazenly altered Simmons' founding narrative. From Leonard Dinnerstein's book about the Frank case, block quote, had it not been for Leo Frank, Simmons would probably have had to wait before launching his venture. But he found in the Knights of Mary Fagan, already organized but with its sense of purpose vanished, a suitable nucleus for the new Klan. In the autumn of 1915, Simmons and 33 of the Knights of Mary Fagan met on a mountaintop just outside Atlanta and brought the Klan into being with elaborate ritual. It should be troubling that the ideological godfathers of American racial terrorism, Thomas Watson and William Simmons, had no apparent knowledge of the Knights of Mary Fagan. Yet several books and articles rely on Dinnerstein's authority to locate the Phantom Group at the very root of the KKK. This extraordinary reinterpretation that removes blacks as the prime target of racial terrorism and replaces them with the Jewish people is no minor feat, and it gives the Ku Klux Klan an entirely new raison d'etre. Remember, NOI has pointed out that Judah Benjamin, the highest-ranking Jew in the Old South, funded some of the original KKK. Now, here we have present at the conception, right? Jew Dinnerstein and these other Jews create a false history to place themselves as the primary victim or intended victim of the KKK, when in fact the KKK is after blacks and it has nothing to do with any supposititious Knights of Mary Fagan, to which there's only one reference. This is all the more incredible because beyond the murder of Leo Frank, Jews have no American history of violent aggression against them, nor were they ever targeted by the Ku Klux Klan. Yet through the saga of Leo Frank, Jews have been able to insert themselves into every analysis of America's long history of domestic racial terrorism, whilst the 4,000 black unnamed and largely forgotten lynching and terror victims are moved to the remote rear. So the Jews, oh no, the Klan was always against Jews. Well, it wasn't against Jews, is what the NOI is saying. They're essentially trying to steal blacks' history of being victims of the Klan. Well, whether that's the black perspective, of course, most of those blacks who were lynched were guilty, and NOI probably even knows that, but still, most of them are hard to trace. White men don't do things for no reason, generally. They're not going to just lynch blacks to lynch blacks. They're doing it for a specific reason, to protect their own community. Anyway, Jews are trying to appropriate black claims of victimization by constructing false history. That's the key here. As the veritable pillars of the industrial and agricultural South, Jews were far more often found using their substantial power in support of the Klan's anti-black activities. But Dinnerstein's boorish rebranding and repurposing of the Klan have no basis in the group's fundamental teachings, which are actually quite respectful of Jews. In fact, William J. Simmons dedicates an entire chapter of his book to refuting the charge that the new Klan is anti-Semitic, and in his entire book, his only references to Jews are overwhelmingly positive. For example, quote, "They, the Orthodox Jews, have a right to be proud in view of all their history, the Hebrew literature, the Hebrew religion, the Hebrew commonwealth, and, more than all, the Hebrew jurisprudence, much of which has been adopted by our Western society, entitles the race to hold to its distinctive qualities and characteristics with a pride that all the world respects and admires." In that same publication, Simmons unreservedly spewed the anti-black racism for which the terrorist group is widely known. It was a bigoted anti-black philosophy which the KKK actually shared with Leo Frank and his top supporters, whose loud and continual insistence that, quote, "Negro testimony" convicted Frank of the Negro crime, and those are quotes, Negro testimony, Negro crime, of murder, was a sophisticated leap beyond even Mr. Simmons's white supremacist agenda. Moreover, while Simmons actually capitalized the word Negro in his 1923 book, Frank's most ardent defender, Adolf Ochs, the Jewish publisher of the New York Times, utterly refused to capitalize Negro in his paper for 7 more years. When the paper finally decided to make the N-word an N-word, a capital N-word, the editors arrogantly wrote that it was in recognition of racial self-respect. So the Jews try to appropriate the actual history of blacks in America and position themselves as the victims of the KKK when they were in fact admired by the people who created the KKK, and they themselves worked with it and helped fund it. Isn't that astonishing? And not what you would think, but true. Next subsection, Jewish Hollywood reinvents the Ku Klux Klan. The driving force behind the reconstituted Ku Klux Klan had nothing to do with Leo Frank or his victim, Mary Fagan. More than any single factor, it was the 1915 release of D.W. Griffith's silent movie epic, The Birth of a Nation, and the massive waves of white supremacy generated by the film's bitter racial nostalgia that fueled the rise of the Ku Klux Klan. So it wasn't the Knights of Mary Fagan and the Leo Frank case that led to the second wave of the Klan. It was The Birth of a Nation, the film. The movie adaptation of the Reverend Thomas Dixon's book titled The Klansman, The Sea, was America's first movie blockbuster, and it effectively presented the Klan's racial philosophy as righteous, inspirational, and as American as apple pie. Using revolutionary techniques in cinematography, the film captivated the white American imagination and transformed the Klan's trail of hate crimes into a heroic heritage, all sold in one viewing to a massive international audience. The Southern Poverty Law Center's 1991 publication, Ku Klux Klan, A History of Racism and Violence, accurately describes the significance of The Birth of a Nation. Block quote, "So powerful was the impact of the movie in 1915 that it is often credited with setting the stage for the Klan revival that same year. In fact, the man who actually created the 20th century Klan used the publicity surrounding it to win recruits to his organization. Birth of a Nation is so blatantly racist that it is rarely shown in public theaters today. The racial hatred exhibited in the movie, once acceptable, is now abhorrent to all but the Klan and the most extreme bigots." No provable link exists between the Leo Frank case and the Ku Klux Klan, but Jews were deeply involved in the original group's founding, growth, and development. Most black Americans would be shocked to learn that it was the Jewish investors who financed the production of what the SPLC argues was the most racist movie ever made, a movie that glorifies anti-black violence and deifies the Ku Klux Klan. The Jewish businessmen could not have been deceived by the movie's noted director, D.W. Griffith, because they invested when the working title was The Klansman. Indeed, the Pittsburgh Jewish Criterion extolled the, quote, great, unquote, film in its October 1st, 1915 edition, page 18. And why wouldn't they? Like so many notable Southerners, Thomas Dixon was violently anti-black racist and an effusively admiring Judeophile. He considered Jews the, quote, greatest race of people God has ever created, unquote. No parallel existed for the film and the publicity that attended it until Adolf Hitler's propaganda ministry began in Nazi Germany a generation later. Jewish promoters greatly enhanced The Birth of a Nation's distribution worldwide, and the greatest of the Hollywood movie studios, Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer, MGM, was started by the famous Jewish mogul Louis B. Mayer, with the profits he earned from distributing the film on the East Coast. The movie opened in Atlanta on December 6, 1915, less than 4 months after Leo Frank's lynching, to rave reviews and general excitement. And most of that excitement was had by the owners of the Atlanta Theater, two Jews, Marcus Klaw, K-L-A-W, and Abraham L. Erlanger, who held a virtual monopoly of theaters in the South. They made a record $27,000 on the Atlanta showing of The Birth of a Nation. That's $650,000 in today's money. The most ever in any Southern theater. It is they, not the Phantom Knights of Mary Fagan, who staged the hate extravaganza requiring a crew of 50 men, including a full symphony orchestra. Thus, 80,000 Georgians saw the most effective Ku Klux Klan recruitment film because Jewish businessmen made it possible. The Jewish theater owners brought the movie back the next year, and at the opening, 1,000 Klan admirers had to be turned away. They even cut the admission price in half so that local Atlanta school children could attend. And though Klaw and Erlanger were based in New York, prominent Jews in Atlanta assisted in the success of the engagement. The Jewish managing editor of the Atlanta Constitution, Jacob Gordatowski, ran many stories trumpeting the film's arrival, including a giant two-page spread with a montage of all the glowing reviews by other newspapers. Accompanying this collection of white newspaper movie reviews were large advertisements by Rich's, Regensteins, and Myers & Miller stores, all displayed prominently next to a story about the local KKK meeting, on the Constitution's Society page. Rothschild's shoes and Elsie Adler's ties were advertised right below an article titled, quote, "Birth of a Nation Thrills Tremendous Atlanta Audience." The Atlanta Journal advertised the film on the same page that it announced the 18 newly elected officers of the Jewish Progressive Club, just a few months after Leo Frank's lynching. Leo Frank frequented the Jewish-owned Jacobs Pharmacy, where on the day of the murder, he claimed, he bought his wife a box of candy. In the Atlanta Constitution on November 7, 1915, Joseph Jacobs advertised the novel his pharmacy was selling, The Birth of a Nation, by Thomas Dixon. Ironically, the Jewish-produced film, The Birth of a Nation, provided the motive and the inspiration for the 1915 rebirth of the Ku Klux Klan. Neither Leo Frank nor Mary Fagan had any provable connection or link to the history of that terrorist group. And the phantom group Knights of Mary Fagan remains a historical anomaly, having no provable connection to anything except the New York Times in one tiny article. Very, very fascinating stuff. You just see here, I guess the takeaway for whites is Jews can turn on a dime. They can back something anti-black and then flip around and back something anti-white. Whatever is good for the Jews, that's how you determine what they are going to do. Whatever they think is good for Jews, they will do that. And truth, facts, history, logic, those have absolutely no bearing on anything. Only what is good for Jews drives them. So that essentially impeaches any intellectual product that they produce. You have to know that they don't care about facts, truth, or justice as most Aryans do. They only care about putting together strings of words that will produce an effect in the mind of the reader that is good for Jews or the viewer or the auditor. We're on 320 now. We got about 10 pages to go. And the new section is, so who lynched Leo Frank? Nearly a century after the crime was committed, we find a few noteworthy attempts to identify the lynchers of Leo Frank, but they all rely exclusively on a mix of rumor, innuendo, and local folklore. Some have even categorized the alleged participants by the various roles they played in the murder as either leaders and planners, field commanders, or foot soldiers, yet none of those named have in any way admitted their involvement. And of those researchers, none refer to the lynchers as the, quote, Knights of Mary Fagan. By any objective analysis, the Knights of Mary Fagan is as fraudulent a concoction and as fantastically false as the claim that Frank's 1913 trial was, quote, mob-dominated and filled with cries of kill the Jew. Neither existed in its time, yet both assertions, though baseless, are now securely ensconced in the Leo Frank legend, and both fabrications have elevated the Leo Frank affair to central places in the narratives of black history. But this still leaves scholars with a critical but unanswered question. Who really killed Leo Frank? How was the New York Times able to invent a group and announce its role as Frank's executioner a full 2 months before the actual lynching? Did the New York Times, which was described by Steve Oney as a full-fledged member of the Leo Frank defense team, know more about the planned murder of Leo Frank than is generally believed or recognized? As with any conspiracy investigation, one must first ask, who benefited? And here is where those who oppressed a myriad of Leo Frank mythologies into the American consciousness get a rude awakening. In 1915, 2 years after his conviction for murder, Leo Frank was an entirely different person in the public's perception from the man he was in reality. The master propagandist at the helm of his massive international public relations campaign, the Chicago-based advertising magnate Albert Lasker, and the New York Times publisher Adolph Ox, had transformed Frank from an unappealing, child-exploiting, sexual strangler into a persecuted, messianic figure, the innocent victim of an anti-Semitic juggernaut, stoically preparing to die for the sins of the South, a little bit-sized Jesus. Through the duo's adroit manipulation of the world's willing press, or Jew-owned press, this superhuman image of Leo Frank as a persecuted Jew was easily perpetuated, as long as he was locked away in Milledgeville Penitentiary and inaccessible to those who had earnestly adopted his cause. But if Frank were released or given free access to the press and the public, there was serious and justifiable doubt about whether he would ever be able to live up to that concocted public image. And that vexed his Jewish supporters. So he might well serve them better just being dead, because the actual article, if allowed to come to light on release, would probably go right back to the same tricks. I mean, hell, if you can rape and strangle and punch and murder and get away with that with Gentile girls, then why not keep on doing it? So again, but if Frank were released or given free access to the press and public, there was serious and justifiable doubt about whether he would ever be able to live up to that concocted public image, and that vexed his Jewish supporters. Many, if not most, had joined the cause to fight for the good name of Judaism and of B'nai B'rith through their symbolic stand with Leo Frank, a man whose private life represented neither very well. The battle had also rallied the Jews of America to a once elusive cultural oneness. But the movement Frank had birthed had achieved a symbolic status that conflicted with Frank's flawed character and abrasive personality. We must remember that Albert Lasker, upon meeting Frank for the first time, in italics, had a viscerally negative reaction to him. Quote, this is from Albert Lasker, the father of modern advertising, who led the campaign to essentially misrepresent Frank to the public. And he said, upon meeting Frank for the first time, quote, "It was very hard for us to be fair to him. He, Frank, impressed us as a sexual pervert. Now, he may not have been, or rather a homosexual, sick, or something like that. There's something off about that boy." According to Lasker's biographer, the men with him during that encounter took, quote, "a violent dislike to him." Well, he's basically a nasty little worm. Even if you're a fellow Jew, you can see he's a nasty little creature with a dark side. Lasker, quote, "hated him and said, I hope he, Frank, gets out. And when he gets out, I hope he slips on a banana peel and breaks his neck." And yet this guy is willing to spend $25,000 equivalent out of his own pocket. And it was in back then money, actually, so it would be much more than that equivalent. But so this guy who completely hates Leo Frank as a man, as a person, as an individual, nevertheless is willing to spend all kinds of man hours, take 6 months off from his own work, spend, you know, $1 million out of his own pocket, essentially, to defend him, even though he hates him and obviously thinks he's probably guilty, or at the best, if he's not guilty, he's still a flippin' pervert. That's how racially loyal Jews are to one another. And when they train that loyalty against us trying to destroy our race, we have to recognize that and take that into account. Because if one Jew will go that far for another who he hates and cannot stand, that's pretty powerful stuff. It really bears thinking on. Another high-profile Jewish supporter, Sears magnate Julius Rosenwald, Sears catalog was big back in the 1800s and early 1900s, selflessly gave $10,000 to Frank's defense, but was agitated at Frank's impersonal thank you note and made it known to others in private correspondence. The Jews orchestrating Frank's PR campaign clearly saw the bigger problem they had created in their single-minded pursuit of Frank's vindication. To turn such a man over to public inspection, even if his supporters believed him to be innocent, was fraught with danger and lethal to their cause. So all people know about Frank, these Jews are thinking, well, look, you know, this guy is really actually kind of nasty. We're presenting him to the public as this heroic little victim of anti-Semitism, but really, if we get him out, if we succeed and get him out, really, we need, the myth is good for the Jews. The facts, the man, the reality are bad for the Jews. So, if, you know, if we just kind of look the other way while these fuckers lynch him, it's probably not the worst thing that could happen. That's how these Jews are thinking about it. And that's why, as NOI says, they didn't do anything after he was lynched. They didn't participate to try to find, after all this endless legal appeals, they didn't do a darn thing to try to find the lynchers. And there's a reason for that, and this is what that reason is, that they knew he was the nasty article, and they knew that it was to their interest, okay, they got him, they killed him, but now we have the myth we've created. Let's just burnish that myth and add lies to it
and use it. Above all, let's use it. To turn such a man over to public inspection, even if his supporters believed him to be innocent, was fraught with danger and lethal to their cause. And if Frank's defenders had accepted that he was indeed the murderer, they certainly could see no value in a living witness to the realities of what had occurred on April 26, 1913, the day of Mary Fagan's demise. As a group, Jewish leaders had made the calculated decision to hold their noses at the particulars of the murder and fight to clear the name of Jews by incidentally clearing Leo Frank of the crime. Their success at achieving the commutation, however, that is, getting the governor to reduce him to a life sentence from death by hanging, proved to be a double-edged sword. The artificial image of victimization that Lasker had created would very likely collapse if Leo Frank were released, and his release from his term of life imprisonment was imminent. The prisoner himself was under the clear impression that as soon as the post-commutation hysteria died down, he would be quietly returned to New York as a free man. B'nai B'rith attorneys Dale M. Schwartz and Charles F. Wittenstein handled the attempts in the 1980s to have Frank pardoned by the state of Georgia. Again, so 70 years later, 50 years later, they're writing lie-filled books about the case. 70 years later, they're trying to get him posthumously cleared or pardoned. So B'nai B'rith attorneys Dale M. Schwartz and Charles F. Wittenstein handled the attempts in the 1980s to have Frank pardoned by the state of Georgia. Schwartz revealed in an interview that, quote, "The game plan, so to speak, was to commute Frank's sentence to life imprisonment, and when the heat was off and people cooled down in a few months, they were probably going to pardon him and let him out of jail altogether, like Jonathan Pollard, say." No one probably feared this more than Frank's closest friends and supporters. In fact, as the public's interest grew, requests flooded in for interviews with Frank, but his attorney, Herbert Haas, was described by Steve Oney as, quote, "dead set against further public comment, fearing that more attention would only increase animosities," unquote. The fact is, both the friends and the enemies of Leo Frank would gain from his elimination. Georgians that had followed the trial were as unanimous as the jury in their belief in Frank's guilt for both murder and the far uglier unofficial charges of perversion, rape, and pedophilia. The few of Georgia's politicians and elites that had aligned with Governor Slayton in commuting Frank's death sentence publicly spouted the proper political platitudes, but after they watched their governor and family be forced into out-of-state exile, whilst the prisoner enjoyed a leisure life of country air and Alberta peaches, Georgia's high and mighty really saw no value in a living Leo who would continue to create deep political division as long as he remained at Milledgeville Prison. And one, if there's one failure of this book, they didn't truly convey to you how close Slayton came to being lynched. It was a pretty hairy escape he had. And then he immediately went up to New York and started giving, where he was welcomed as a hero by the Jews up there. We found that in other audiobooks we've done about Leo Frank. Similarly, incoming Governor Nathaniel E. Harris rushed to the side of Leo M. Frank when the prisoner's throat was cut by a fellow inmate, and he recalled, quote, "While the doctor was washing the wound, Frank coughed, and I asked the doctor immediately, with a good deal of sympathy in my voice, 'Won't that wound attack his lungs before it heals?' When I asked this, Frank laughed a queer sort of laugh, a laugh that showed, at least to me, a hard, careless heart, and the doubt which I had had about his guilt was lessened greatly as I heard the laugh and looked into his face. I could not help the impression. Looking back on it now, I do not see why I should have been impressed, but I felt then that the man was undoubtedly a hardened criminal or a reckless prisoner." So Leo Frank is a very two-faced sort of fellow. Frank's image was far more attractive in the hands of experts like master marketer Albert Lasker than in Frank's own hands. Ox's assessment of Frank's personality mirrored that of Lasker and Harris. Assistant editor at the Times, Garrett Garrett, kept a diary in which he revealed, "I'm sure at last it was a relief to Mr. Ox to have Frank lynched and out of the way. I have felt for some time that he secretly despised Frank." So all these Jews, they know the reality. They know that he's a scummy little bastard and that he did exactly what he's accused of. They just lie in public, and that's how Jews are. There was actually a saying about that two-facedness of the Jewish tribe: British in public, Yiddish in private. And that goes for any country they're located in. Clearly, if Frank were actually released into the sympathetic arms of the public, his own repellent personality would reveal the very opposite of Jewish victimhood. The presumption of innocence would have vanished, and the massive campaign to free him would be exposed for what it actually was, namely a flexing of Jewish power and a demonstration of might that would have reinforced every stereotype of the powerful Jewish banker and debauched Jewish corrupter. Now, basically, you remember the campaign to free Mamiya, and they have all these, the Pope and all these other assholes writing articles and telling, well, they had that for Leo Frank, and that was probably the first time in history you had that. All these people are having their arm twisted. These goyim, these Jews, are writing all kinds of letters and telegrams are being sent to the governor. Oh, free poor little Leo Frank, victim of anti-Semitism. When he's actually exactly what the people of Georgia on the jury found him to be, a nasty little murderer and sex pervert. Certainly, Tom Watson would have had a field day with that argument. And if Frank, the, quote, careless, queer, all these quotes, despised and hated sexual pervert, all those quotes, careless, queer, despised, and hated sexual pervert, were released from prison with Mary Fagan's murder unavenged, the Jews of the South, for the first time, might have found themselves in actual physical danger. It's back then whites defended themselves from blacks or Jews. Frank's teetering on the brink of death served only to inflame his ego, whereby he had actually come to believe his own press. Oney had to admit that the sight of his name in print mesmerized him, and he also quoted Ox. Frank would feel cheated if he did not have a chance to make a speech from the scaffold. And, as shown in his ultra-rehearsed but disastrous trial statement, his own open mouth made him his own open enemy. Frank's own lawyers admonished him about it. Herbert Haas wrote to him, "Let me caution you against giving out interviews. A friend of ours advised us today that interviews from you were appearing in Northern and Eastern papers. I think you should not do this." New section on 325. New trial, new trouble. Prosecutor Hugh Dorsey had promised that if the High Court ever granted Frank the new trial he asked for, he would prosecute the case to the fullest extent. But this time around, it would be with the world watching very carefully. A new judge, jury, and prosecutor with the same physical evidence would probably proceed in much the same way as the first trial. Every court that reviewed the month-long trial found it to have been conducted fairly, and with all eyes on a second trial, Georgia would be on its best judicial behavior. And just like the first, the second would not have gone well for Leo Frank. He probably would have fared much, much worse. This time, Frank's attorneys would have to show the Negro testimony far more respect. Their blatantly racist strategy would have to be retired. The Northern press, which had taken up Frank's cause as a victim of anti-Jewish racial prejudice, could not very well ignore the anti-black bigotry coming from Frank's own side. Black newspapers and advocacy groups outside Georgia were monitoring the treatment of the blacks in the case with a jaundiced eye. In any new trial, those blacks with significant testimony, like James Conley and Newt Lee, would actually have competent attorneys not only representing them and their interests, but also ensuring that the Frank team's open and abusive race baiting, a cornerstone of their defense, was severely muzzled. William Burns's bungling on Frank's behalf only added many more felonies to the docket. As Lasker later admitted, quote, "By God, Burns put in much perjured stuff before we finished." Should the defense try to introduce any of Burns's perjured stuff, it would have been an invitation for the prosecution to air all of Burns's felonies. Certainly, his illegal methods and activities were a matter of public record, so the prosecutors would not even need to wait for a trial to have it all fed to the gathered hordes of international newsmen. It was more likely, not less, that a new Georgia judge would allow the young female factory workers to be more explicit about Frank's offensive behavior. Thus, the more detailed revelations would have had a far more damaging effect on Frank's case. The second time around would be disastrous if Frank's lawyers again refused to cross-examine them or challenge their accounts. In fact, by the end of the first trial, Frank's attorneys conceded in open court the truth of the factory employees' charges. and there was no telling how many more girls and young women might be emboldened to come forward on an international stage. And of course, they did not need a courtroom to air their negative experiences with Frank. Dorsey had already threatened to unleash a mass of Leo Frank's dark secrets. A mass of, in quotes. And the two hired detective firms, the Burns Agency and the Pinkertons, were now estranged from Frank and could easily be called to testify about their intimate knowledge of the investigation. Again, this unfiltered and unstoppable flow of sludge would potentially reach a massive international audience preconditioned by Ox and Lasker to hear of nothing but Frank's innocence, sacrifice, and suffering, and not his management of a factory filled with child laborers working 10-hour days under the constant threat and reality of sexual harassment. And at any new trial, and with the outside world watching, it would be almost impossible for Frank himself to avoid cross-examination by the prosecution, as he did at his first trial. His millions of new minions had been led to believe that his voice had been drowned out by anti-Semitism, so it would have been impossible for him to avoid a direct and sworn interrogation. This time, the three Atlanta daily newspapers would be competing with hundreds of others from all over America and around the world. Soon their articles and editorials would ask the same legitimate questions that emerged during and after the first trial about the planted evidence, including Newt Lee's bloody shirt and changed time card, and about Manola McKnight's and Nina Formby's revealing affidavits. And now, thanks to the William J. Burns fiasco, the prosecutors would have the forged Carter and Roan letters, the open bribery, the poison plot against Conley, and Slayton's incredible conflict of interests. All would become known, and all would tend to point inescapably to Frank's guilt. So if they actually did get the second trial that they wanted in all their appeals, it would have gone worse for them, in all likelihood, than the first did. Certainly, as the details of the Burns operation emerged, so would it be revealed who orchestrated and paid for it all. The reputations of Ox and his New York Times, the prestige of Lewis Marshall and the American Jewish Committee, the stature of B'nai B'rith and its brand new Anti-Defamation League, the eminence of notable supporters like behind-the-scenes financier Albert Lasker, Rabbi David Marks, philanthropist Julius Rosenwald, and banker Jacob Schiff, all of whom had bought into or helped generate the Noble Frank narrative, would be scrutinized in any new trial and its accompanying publicity. They had not just supported Leo Frank, their scorched earth extra-legal tactics had backfired and instead infuriated white Georgians, not to mention blacks across America. Nearly all institutions of the government, the judiciary, and the press had succumbed to the cash tsunami precipitated by Lasker's corrupt generosity. The crusading Tom Watson and his weekly Jeffersonian were absent from the first trial, but he would have had worldwide exposure in a second. And this time Watson would no doubt be considered the only legitimate voice of the people of Georgia, and neither Frank nor his attorneys were a match for him. Yeah, that's right. One white man can dominate the Jews. Because he has the truth on his side, and he's brilliant besides. Entire organized Jewish apparatus is less than Tom Watson. Watson had successfully cast the attack on his state of Georgia as a Jewish attack, which it was. And by the summer of 1915, Watson and the Jewish publications of the North were in a ferocious battle that threatened to morph into a real Jewish-Gentile confrontation of the European variety. Watson showed no signs of caving in to the intense Jewish pressure, and with his every salvo, his popularity among Georgians soared. He would be champing at the bit for such an opportunity. For the relatively tiny Jewish population in Georgia, a state that had always welcomed them, remember Georgia began as a Catholic colony, it was uncharted territory. It was a battle the Jewish people could not possibly win and would be foolish to engage in. The unpleasant truth is that there was no scenario the Jewish world could conceive of in which Frank or his carefully crafted image of Jewish persecution could prevail. The convict himself resorted to this unseemly attempt to engineer his own victimhood with its rank insensitivity to the way in which Mary Fagan perished. Quote, orderly trial by a jury is one thing. The rank disorder of a lynch-crazy mob is another. But I am confident that the truth cannot be strangled to death. What a thing to say when he knows that he strangled her to death. He's just rubbing her own face, almost laughing at them in the typical Jewish way. More chutzpah for him to say that. The truth can't be strangled to death. When it comes right down to it, whoever murdered Leo Frank had many supporters, allies, and cheerleaders from a surprising cross-section of America. The Jewish community's refusal to press for the apprehension or even the investigation of the lynchers raises strong suspicions about their real identity. The day after Frank's murder, the New York Times reported, quote, Mrs. Leo Frank received the news that her husband had been lynched in a manner that led those present to believe that she had been expecting it. And perhaps she had. Could it be that the Knights of Mary Fagan was invented out of whole cloth and then planted by the New York Times 2 months before Frank's demise in order that a Gentile group be set up and made responsible for a future crime? The same nefarious forces that planted anti-Semitism in the trial and planted Newt Lee's bloody shirt, among all the other perjured stuff admitted to by Lasker, were Frank's likely executioners. Indeed, if Adolf Ochs in the New York Times, 900 miles away, claimed to know of a murder plot against their new sacred symbol of anti-Semitism, they certainly did nothing to stop it, or to enhance Frank's security, or to alert authorities responsible for his protection. The alleged Knights encountered almost no resistance to their operation to abduct the most important prisoner in the world. Steve Oney is considered by many to be the foremost expert on the Leo Frank case, as his research and thesis are accepted by the ADL and other interested pro-Frank Jewish organizations. As he reflected on the lynching, he made an incredible correlation that carries far more weight than he probably intended. " Steve Oney, it's fascinating the way it was planned, the way that 7 or 8 leading citizens of Marietta put it together and delegated authority down the line, and chose a group of lieutenants who actually ran the lynch party. The lieutenants chose the 20 or 30 guys who served as muscle. It was like the raid on Entebbe. It was a very well-oiled machine. Operation Entebbe was a hostage rescue mission performed by commandos of the Israeli Defense Force, IDF, at Entebbe Airport in Uganda on July 4, 1976. Oney's reference to it is chillingly appropriate. Leo Frank as a Jewish symbol could never exist in the same space and time with Leo Frank, the flawed and repulsive Jewish man. And so the man became as expendable to Jewish elites as he was to Georgian Gentiles, maybe even more so. So like this guy's, we know he's guilty, we know he's a little scumbag, but we can still use him, but we can only use him, not if he's free, that's just our superficial desire and complaint and legal pretext, but we can really use him if he's dead. Then there's no real man to contrast with the imaginary victim we've created through our media control and our money. So Leo Frank's not in a good position when basically everybody would when everybody would benefit from you being dead, you're probably not going to live much longer. That's you're a little 4-foot-tall Jewish wiener dog. I mean, your days are friggin' numbered when the Jews and the Georgians and the Gentiles alike benefit from you being underground after you learn to walk on air. That bleak outlook called into play a little-known option that is afforded to Jews in such a predicament. In Hebrew, it is called Din Moser. Two words, Din, D-I-N, Moser, M-O-S-E-R. Law of the Informer, in quotes. Din Moser, Law of the Informer, and Din Rodef, Law of the Pursuer, R-O-D-E-F. Din Moser, Law of the Informer, and Din Rodef, Law of the Pursuer. And they are concepts found in the Babylonian Talmud, Tractate Sanhedrin, Folio 73a. These are literally contract killings ordered by Jewish authorities against a Jew that is thought to have betrayed or will betray Jewish interests. The Leo Frank case had now involved the highest Jewish authorities in America and put their reputations and their constituencies in a league with a truly rogue character who had outlived his symbolic value. The launch of Leo Frank was a spectacular, but a crash and burn was imminent. The launch of Leo Frank was spectacular, but a crash and burn was imminent, and the consequences would be disastrous for the Jewish people. And even though Leo Frank, as president of B'nai B'rith, cannot be said to have deliberately betrayed the Jewish people, his malfeasance had maneuvered them into a compromised position. "You're going to get the Goyim to see us for what we are, you little sawed-off asshole." The Dinro Def, Law of the Traitor, thus became an attractive option.
According to the rabbinical authorities, Frank might have been considered a Rodef, one who has placed Jews in harm's way, and when that occurs, an individual or community is permitted to stop a Rodef by any means necessary. In more recent times, scholars have now acknowledged that the 1995 assassination of Israeli Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin was just such a Din Rodef contract murder ordered by a special court of Israeli rabbis. By conceding to the Palestinians land that many Jews believe was conferred to them by God himself, in Genesis 15:17, Rabin was said to have betrayed the Jewish people. The assassin, rabbinical student Yigal Amir, justified his act on that very basis, telling police that he was acting on the basis of a rabbinical Din Rodef ruling. So Yigal Amir said, "Hey, I was acting on the basis of a Din Rodef ruling." "Once something is a ruling, there is no longer a moral issue," said Amir. Leo Frank presented the Jews with a moral issue, a dilemma not of their choosing. Given the extent to which they went to extract Frank from the justice of the secular courts of Georgia, it may all have been for the purpose of exacting their own higher Jewish justice on the errant Rodef. The facts and circumstances of Leo Frank's lynching lead almost inescapably in that Talmudic direction. Steve Oney's incredibly shrewd observation that the 1915 raid on Milledgeville was very much like the Israeli raid on Entebbe 61 years later may be a precise description. And that's where we'll end for today. Very, very interesting stuff. A lot of counterintuitive history. You would think, you know, it's always presented as, oh, the Klan was after the Jews just as much as after the blacks. No, not in fact true. Jews, again, are found to be lying about history. Wherever you investigate, you always find them lying. Just as whenever you see some social ill and you cast a light on it, a little Jewish roach scurries away, as Hitler more or less said. I want to thank you for being with me today. Again, I'm Alex Linder, and you can find this at VNNforum.com, all these recordings that we do. And I'll be back with you again real, real soon, and we'll pick up with more answers to unanswered questions in the Leo Frank case, the lynching of a guilty man.